From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For many of the world's religions, hell has lost its street cred. For centuries, eternal fire and brimstone was a pretty good motivator to keep the faithful in line. But these days, more and more religions are ditching the fear part in favor of the gentler ideas of love and universal salvation. But hell is not going away. It turns out it's pretty useful in popular culture. One of the scholars on today's program says hell gives us a mechanism to deal with injustice and evil. Just look at the headlines about environmental catastrophes or acts of terrorism. Hell, hell, hell. Today in the program, we're talking about the idea of hell, where it came from, and why we still seem to need it. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. So here's a question. Is a show about hell? That's what our show is about today. Is that a show about religion? Now, it could be. It's often what comes to people's minds when they think of hell, a scary place of torment where God sends the sinners. But the scholars on our program today say a discussion about hell really is about a lot more than that. They say it's a vehicle through which humans discuss a lot of stuff, identity and culture, the problem of evil and suffering. It's a way we talk about environmental disasters and terrorism and, of course, death. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of hell, I guess, and the future of it, too, if it has one. The University of Utah's Isabel Morera and Margaret Toscano are with us today, co-editors of a book called Hell and Its Afterlife. Isabel Morera is a professor of history specializing in religion. She's also the author of Heaven's Purge, Purgatory in Late Antiquity. And Professor Morera, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
And Margaret Toscano, associate professor of classics and comparative literature, specializes in religion, gender, and myth. And Professor Toscano, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, I guess just let me get a straightforward sense from you. What is it? What interests you about the idea of hell? Isabel Morera, mm-hmm. You first. Like, what were you drawn to this as a subject topic, and what? What about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think initially I came to it because I had written a book on visions of the afterlife. And, of course, you know, hell is a big part of those visions. It turns out, actually, hell is often the majority part of those visions. and since it sort of clearly sort of interested people in the past, as a historian, I was very interested in why that was so, why that was the case. And, you know, thoughts about hell, I mean, it just, as you said, it sort of connects you back to so many other issues. And what happens is that once you start talking about hell, you start talking about everything. And the conversation just goes on and on. And I think Margaret and I have been talking about hell for about 10 years.
It's true. And the conversation goes on.
Right.
That's right.
Because it does relate to so many issues.
Yeah.
I mean, back to your question, I originally got interested in the notion because of my writings on theology. And as you mentioned, Doug, it connects with issues of justice and punishment mm-hmm. and so many things in religion. But also because I'm a classicist, there are so many ancient texts that deal with the narrative of going down to hell for various reasons and coming back. So I asked the question, why? And those narratives are still popular. Why are they still popular? What does it mean to have a story about going to the underworld and coming back again?
You know, we asked people what they think would be hell or what hell is like. And let me give you a couple of responses because I think they – now, we had some religious responses, of course, and we'll get to that. But here's one that comes from our friend Connor. Hell equals Costco on a Saturday. from Michael, hell would be 500 channels on TV and all of them – General Conference, which says that hell is just something brutal and miserable. They don't, they're not literally thinking of a place, but I guess this gets to the idea that hell is a concept.
Mm-hmm. That exactly.
That we connect to, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a concept. It's a metaphor. It's a story that helps us deal with the uncomfortable parts of our existence. It helps us deal with suffering. It helps us deal with questions that we're troubled by.
But notice that you know, the idea of Costco as hell. I mean, how well that actually fits with the iconography of hell, which is always of crowds,
right,
of people,
you know, endless aisles of something.
Things,
yeah.
You know, in some senses, you know, we still use the notion of hell correctly in terms of the iconography of it.
Right.
Well, and that's why I think knowing something about the history of hell can be helpful, because, in fact, that whole question of that something that's endless can turn out to be a torment, that mm-hmm. goes way back.
Yeah.
Right. So trying to understand why is that mm-hmm. scary to us? Mm-hmm. Why does that frighten us? That's an important question.
Yeah. I want to get to that. I want to talk about this image that you've chosen for the cover of your book. This is Rodin's sculpt. Well, I think a lot of people, when they think of Rodin's The Thinker, it immediately comes to mind. Oh, mm-hmm. it's and you probably saw it in a sculpture garden somewhere, and it was disconnected with right. anything else. But mm-hmm. Rodin created that image in the context of a much bigger figure. It was mm-hmm. this. It was called the Gates of Hell, and this is important to your way of thinking about all of this. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the sculpture, The Thinker, you have this figure who is contemplating the meaning of life, right? So he's contemplating, you know, what about suffering? What about human existence? What is this all about? And the very fact that Rodin wanted this as sort of the prominent figure on his Gates of Hell says that that is the context in which he wanted it to be associated. But, of course, it's been disassociated with that. And yet, so when you reassociate it, it connects the idea of hell, which I'm not sure Rodin believed in,
right.
literally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he's using it again as a metaphor yeah. for right. thinking about these big problems of human existence.
And so that's what the thinker is imagining, not just mm-hmm. who belongs in hell, who gets into hell, who goes out of hell, but the bigger concepts that we're talking about?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, Rodin's thinker, I mean, I had always seen it in isolation. And it sort of was a rather a puzzling kind of pose. You know, what is that? What does it mean? But put in the context of hell, and especially over Gates of Hell, I mean, yeah. that was the other thing that was so interesting for us, was the notion that hell has gates. You know, heaven has gates, but hell also has gates. And just the idea that, you know, a gate is something that can be opened mm-hmm. and it's something that can be closed. And, you know, that was an image that really came out of all the contributions in our book. And that's why it was really so perfect an image for the book.
We've been talking a little bit about what is, you know, hell as a cultural metaphor. And we'll talk a little bit more about this particular idea. But even if we stripped it out of religion, which there tends to be a sense that most of the religions, or many religions anyway, are trying to sort of get rid of a literal idea of a hell. But you've said that even if we did strip it out of religion, we would still have ideas of hell. Why? Because of what we're talking about? We need something to connect our anxiety about death, and something to explain that horrible environmental disaster, or that awful image we saw on the news related to terrorism, or, you know, poverty, or whatever. It's just a helpful metaphor.
I think definitely that's really at the center of what we're talking about. That as human beings, we need stories and we need metaphors to deal with issues, to even think about those issues. It's not just that we need them to kind of because they're fun or because they're interesting or whatever. I think at the very core of what it means to think, so we're back to the thinker, mm-hmm. or to communicate, or to get out from what is inside of us, those repressed anxieties that we don't even know are there. So I think it's very central to what it means to be human. One of the things that it means to be human is that we need stories, we need metaphors, mm-hmm. we need language mm-hmm. that helps us narrate and visualize our experiences.
And we all have devil figures from our religious upbringings or our past, or I mean that those. So that's an image we can access pretty quickly, I guess. A lot of us anyway, yeah. Right?
I think we need monsters.
Yeah.
We need monsters. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And again, it's just such a very common image. I mean, even if you haven't had a religious upbringing, most people are familiar with these images. They are so powerful and, you know, obviously they have a very long history. But interestingly enough, I think, you know, some of the iconography was set for Christians, you know, fairly early, and yeah. it's persisted so that, you know, if you see The Simpsons, you know when the devil appears, right?
Right.
Right.
Or South Park.
Or South Park.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And in fact, many people today, their first experience with these images may be through popular culture.
Right.
I think increasingly so.
Yeah.
Right. And
yes.
Yet popular culture is drawing on these images and these stories from the past,
right.
Very much so. And even a film like Hellboy, which we have a chapter on in our book,
yeah.
Some of the name Samael goes back to Jewish apocalyptic texts from late antiquity. And most people don't know that, but these names come from a long tradition, and they get transferred from a religious context to a secular popular context.
Let's talk about the origins of all of this, mm-hmm. because it seems, I mean, a lot of people think hell was sort of a byproduct or it was a product of religious thinking. But you mention, and it's talked about in your book, philosophers were as much a part of the development of hell as religious thinkers. Is that right?
That is correct. And in fact, probably the dominant philosopher is Plato. Mm-hmm. Plato was interested in the question of how can we create a moral society. So some of the readers may have read his Republic, where he talks about what is the ideal society. And a question for every society is, how do we get people to behave? Do we need some form of punishment, whether in this life or in the next life, to encourage people to be their best selves so that we can have a more productive society? So in the Republic, Plato creates a myth, if you want to call it that, a myth in the best sense of the word, not a false story, but a story that illustrates these important ideas. But I think it reflects his real views, that he believes that after you die, the soul goes through a judgment. And depending on how you lived, you will have to go through some suffering.
Yeah.
But after 1,000 years, you get released, and then you get reborn into another incarnation. And hopefully you come to a point after several of these cycles where you are a better person and you are going to be a more productive person in human society. So this is definitely true, that it's in philosophy, not just religion.
But of course, I mean, it's possible to make a false distinction between philosophy and
Absolutely.
Religion
right.
and science
yeah.
in
yeah.
the ancient world
yeah.
because
they were
these were all
in,
you know, intimately connected. And so, you know, the creation of the cosmos, you know, it has to reflect these ideas. And, you know, what you find, the reason that, you know, Platonic thought is so powerful is because it sort of encapsulated the state of the art mm-hmm. of, you know, what the cosmos looks like and sort of what our role in it is. And, you know, what we're all doing here and what we should be striving for. And so, you know, Platonic philosophy has its long history, especially in Christianity also.
Right. He was definitely a huge influence on the mm-hmm. early Christian theologians. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to remark that Plato was reacting against ideas in the Greek traditional religion that he didn't like. But he still believed in an afterlife, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he just didn't believe in some of the stories that had been handed down to him. So he was trying to recreate what he felt was maybe some better stories that would explain what he thought it would be. But again, it's not like this distinction between he's a philosopher mm-hmm. and then there were the religious people. It's more complex than that.
Yeah, and over time, you know, Plato's works become more religion, mm-hmm. sort of this move towards thinking of them as more religion. The myths become sort of more religious, you know, as time goes on.
Did Plato, you know, think of the term scare the hell out of you, you know, the idea that hell was a motivator for people who thought about the way to construct a society, that if you stripped out the idea of there being some sort of punishment at the end of the road, people may just sort of behave on whim. Mm-hmm. You needed something to motivate them to be good. Was Plato thinking of it in that sense?
Yeah, there was sort of that moral component. And of course, that's sort of what also, Christian hell is about. It's sort of introducing that moral component into hell. You know, obviously, there were ideas about the underworld previous to that did not have that sort of component. And yes, it does reflect back on what was the purpose of the underworld in those systems.
And of course, many scholars have argued that hell is useful in that sense, that if you look at the history of hell, hell has been seen as useful to help create a moral society and to educate people. But the point you make is really important that, there are notions of the underworld that are earlier than Plato that don't have as strong a component of let's scare people to hell.
Well, it wasn't anciently. There's some discussion about the idea that anciently hell wasn't really a bad place. Mm-hmm. Kind of a place where it was a storage place for the dead people, and some of them went in certain places. It was kind of – there were different categories, I guess, where you went. And again, going to maybe to Plato's idea, this is where you developed. This is where you learned. This is where you improved. Mm-hmm. You paid some penance, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
So if we go to the classical idea of the underworld – Hades is not hell in the sense of the Christian hell.
Right.
And Hades, the god, is not the devil. I have to tell my classical myth students this all the time. This is not the same as Christian ideas of hell and the devil. It is – the underworld is a place where everybody goes, whether you're good or bad. And although in the earliest text, as in Homer, there are hints of punishment, although that's not the major focus of Hades or the underworld, because you do have some classic sinners who are being punished. Sisyphus, who is eternally rolling the rock up the hill or the mountain, and then it rolls back down and he has to start all over again. Or Tantalus, who, can't get, food or drink, even though he's standing in water and has fruit over his head. So there are these images, but that's not the major concept of the underworld. It's more of the place where everybody goes, which seems a little grim. And then eventually, by the time you get to Virgil, so Homer is like 700 BC. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to Virgil, who's like at the time of Christ, the Emperor Augustus, he has more of the moral hell, like Plato.
So eventually it does shift that way.
Exactly. It shifts that direction, but it's not like that at first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, but for the Christian hell, it was a moral place. I mean, Christianity was taking on sort of movements in that direction that were already there in sort of very late Jewish literature. And so for them, it is a moral hell. Some of the earlier ones, Homer and even Virgil, I mean, these are sort of form part of literature. They form part of, a different sort of source. Christianity, of course, is a religion. So they're much more interested, in moral questions and sort of keeping that at the forefront.
What about this idea of the eternal torment or, mm-hmm. This whole the Sisyphus idea that there's no end to the torment. There's no end to his task. There's no end to this. That's an important theme here, right?
It's an important theme from beginning to end. And, of course, with Sisyphus, you say, well, it's not so bad to push a rock up a hill. I mean, it's not like being, tormented with fire or something, right, or worms eating at all of your organs. But it's the endless quality. And, of course, this has become one of the major issues in discussion of hell. Is there an escape? Can you get out of hell? And that has been a major question in discussions from ancient to modern about hell.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and eternal—the whole issue of eternal hell in Christianity is—it's a big issue, and it takes some time for that notion to be truly embedded. It becomes sort of Catholic theology of the Middle Ages, but for a long time there was a lot of differentiation of opinion on this. Would hell be eternal? Is it entirely out of the capacity of rescue or recourse?
And Plato saying you can get out of it in 1,000 years,
right?
Yeah, Here are a couple of comments that come from our Facebook page. Christy writes, my lack of belief in hell became the foundation of my current religious beliefs, or lack thereof. Also, if you only behave because you're afraid you'll go to hell otherwise, you're pretty selfish, right? I guess I should be glad that those who really do behave better because they fear hell still believe in it. Dennis writes, hell is of your own making. Norlene says, I hope there is a hell for rapists, killers, and especially child killers. Which that leads to this question of justice, our idea of wanting there to be a place, whether we believe in a literal place or not, something that makes sense out of evil, because we want justice. I want to talk about that when we get back from a break. We have with us Margaret Toscano, an associate professor of classics and comparative literature here at the University of Utah, and Isabel Morera, a professor of history here at the U. Together, they are editors of a book. It's called Hell and Its Afterlife, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Radio West on KDWR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we are talking about hell, about the underworld or the inferno or the bottomless pit, but not just as a place. We're also talking about hell as an idea, as a concept, because it's been around for a very long time. The University of Utah's Isabel Morera and Margaret Toscano are with us today, co-editors of a compilation of essays related to hell called Hell and Its Afterlife. And I wanted to get to this pretty strong statement that came from our Facebook page right before the break, that, you know, I hope if there is a place, I hope, you know, child rapists and molesters go there, which gets at this idea of, I guess, why we need hell as a way to help us explain suffering and injustice. Talk about that.
Well, I think that, you know, the sort of punitive view of hell sort of is appealing because it sort of, you know, answers the need that people have to truly punish people like child molesters and so forth. And of course, that is the sort of traditional way of thinking about, you know, people who get away with murder, literally, or people who evade justice. I mean, that's another sort of big category. So, you know, a punitive hell, I think, speaks to that idea. I mean, I hope, you know, that we can also think about other ways of other thoughts about justice. But, you know, clearly that is the appeal of the traditional view of hell.
I think it's interesting that the comments you read, Doug, right before the break, reflect a sort of tension or dichotomy in current thought. On the one hand, most people don't believe in hell, and it may be one of their reasons for rejecting religion, because they don't like the idea of a punitive God. On the other hand, and people also feel that really bad people should be eventually punished.
Yeah.
So they feel both. We feel both of those simultaneously, which I think really reflects a sort of this almost like contradiction in the human psyche. We want both at the same time. So when they've surveyed people, there's been a rapid decline of the belief in hell, and yet people say if they do believe in it, most people think they're not going to go there. And if you say, well, who will go there is people like Hitler or Stalin or, you know, some other horrible person who's perpetrated just enormous evil. So we feel both of those simultaneously.
Here's a comment from Lamar, who writes, hell is nothingness, no faith, no hope, no love. He says, no fire or torment. That's Rush Limbaugh's gig, which is to say there's a conventional idea of it means, you know, you're going to be tormented. But what Lamar is saying seems really profound. Hell is this lack of all hope. It's just nothingness. Is that a common theme that you see?
Well, it's a clearly a common theme. You think of Dante entering the portals of hell and you know, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. This sort of nothingness, this lack of love, this lack of community with your fellow man, and your lack of connection to God, this sense of alienation. This is, you know, it's a really current view today, but it's also a very very ancient view as well.
It's the existential hell.
Yeah.
So if any of you have read No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre, mm-hmm. that is where you're stuck in this room with people you don't like, with very ugly furnishings, and you can't get out of the room. You're not tortured, but it is this place of discomfort and boredom mm-hmm. where you're stuck forever.
And there's no meaning.
There's no meaning to mm-hmm. it. It doesn't lead to anything. You don't get released. You don't get better. It's just meaningless.
What about Samuel Beckett? I mean, doesn't he get at that a little bit too? I mean, at Waiting for Godot, I don't imagine that's hell necessarily, but it could be.
I think so. Yeah. I think there are a lot of writers that create that sort of picture of, and again, they're not talking, I don't think, about a reality of an afterlife that they believe in, but they're talking about contemporary culture. Mm-hmm. And that's another huge theme, that mm-hmm. we have created so much hell on earth that we don't need the hell of an afterlife.
Yeah.
So we need a heaven in the afterlife. We've created hell on earth.
Did you want to – I'm just imagining the images from the genocide in Rwanda.
Absolutely.
I'm imagining the aftermath of a hurricane or of a tornado. I mean, that's about as real as it gets, and that's hell.
Right.
It is.
And we're more aware of it because these are images that we get across the media. And, you know, in the modern era, as Margaret says, it's really hard almost to justify, you know, a punishing kind of vision of hell when we have hell on earth so clearly, you know, shown to us every day.
And I think the media is very important here. One of our essays by Rachel Falconer, she talks about how, you know, the media presents us every day with images of hell. You know, these very strong visual images of suffering that's going on all over the world, which is almost unendurable that you can think about this too much.
She mentions in her essay, I really liked it, because she uses particular headlines, London bombs, souls prayed aloud as hell cloaked capital, escape the tunnel of hell, hell's hole, nightmare as cops dig out the last 20 dead. Hell on earth. I mean, you see these images all throughout. I mean, you know, secular newspaper articles that have nothing to do, but they're connecting to a concept that's philosophical, that's religious.
And of course, you know, to emphasize what you just read, those are quotes from newspapers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so Rachel is arguing that we need this kind of language, which definitely goes back to the religious concepts, to help us deal with the suffering that we have in contemporary culture. She's saying it's necessary in that way.
Yeah, and comes back to the desire to make meaning out of this, that we're very uncomfortable with the meaninglessness of a modern view of hell.
And, of course, that's one of the things she explores. She says there are two big, you know, camps in modern philosophy about suffering. One that says it's totally meaningless, which goes more to the existential writings I was referring to. But the other group that want to create meaning out of it, we have that need, right? We want to create it so we're not left with that sense of hopelessness.
Let's take some calls. Dan is with us, calling from Murray, Utah. Dan, welcome.
Hey, well, thank you so much. The show, I really enjoy the show. My point is, and I can only speak as a Catholic, but we believe that if you believe in an afterlife, that and you believe in free will, that there
lost him there. Somebody did talk to him earlier, and I think what Dan was trying to say is, he says if you believe in free will and you believe in an afterlife, they're, he said, intricately connected. No hell, no free will, and vice versa. And he says he finds that people don't believe in free will anymore either. What about that? Is there a connection between free will and hell? Catholic Dan says there is.
Well, you know, free will suggests that you make choices and that something will come out of those choices. And, you know, obviously that's a really important notion about, you know, what hell is. It's a place for people who have chosen not to be part of God's kingdom, viewed from, a Catholic perspective.
Yeah.
And then the question arises, well, if you can choose to do bad things and therefore you deserve hell, should you later on be able to choose something better and to repent and therefore get out of hell? So that's why that's part of the discussion. But I think choice is very important to these questions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phone. Dan, thanks. Good try anyway. Sorry we lost your connection there. Let's try Emma. Irma, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Thank you. I believe hell is a state of being. That I was in a 23-year marriage until I got out of, I didn't realize I was in hell. And that choosing to get out of that brought me out of hell into a happier place. And that my religion actually supported my staying in that abusive, fearful place.
Want to respond?
So this is a dominant theme that comes out in narratives about hell, that it's not simply a real place, it's a psychological state.
Yeah.
And the question is, what puts you into that psychological state and what allows you to get out of it? And, of course, some people would think that therapy is the thing that helps you, or they might think your church either puts you there or helps you get out of it. But that's definitely a dominant idea, that it's a psychological state.
George, with us in Layton. George, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. And thank you for the show, Layton. My comment is that I'm from the East, and we had a phraseology expression out there that was, oh, my God. And when I came out here, especially from my mother-in-law, what I would hear is, oh, my hell.
Maybe it's not so bad to invoke hell as it is to invoke God.
Yeah, well, what is that about? That is so interesting. I mean, you do hear that a lot around here, right? And it must, I'm sure it's not just unique to Utah.
Yeah, or oh heck, right? Which
or
is
oh,
the
heck,
softened version, right, of
yeah,
hell.
Yeah, that is it. But what is that? You're invoking hell as opposed to invoking God. That's interesting. You guys thought about that? There's an essay in there somewhere.
Maybe there is. I don't know if this leads to another aspect of hell we haven't talked about, but hell can be funny. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of jokes about hell. And so to me, that's a really interesting question. Why do we make jokes about hell? What is it that makes us laugh about hell?
When gallows it can be so humor ghastly? Kind of thing? Well, maybe that's it, right? Mm-hmm. It's because it's that angst, that existential angst, and all you can do is laugh.
Well, I think that's a major component of all humor. The things we're uncomfortable about, we often make jokes about because it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think there's more to it.
Kevin writes, while I attended a very liberal seminary, I still consider myself an evangelical, albeit a very liberal one. And whenever I'm asked why I hold on to the concept of hell, I tell people it's because I believe in cosmic justice. That is, certain people can pass through this world and escape any form of justice, but these folks end up in some form of hell that allows them to be aware, to repent, and to heal from their sin, and either return to the communion of the saints, as he puts it, or stay where they choose to suffer for their unwillingness to learn kindness. Is this a theme you hear?
Well, that sort of really, I think, you know, addresses the other view of hell, which is that you know, this world is a place of suffering, and that human beings can should be able to learn from that suffering, and that sort of viewed from a cosmic perspective, that if the soul's redemption cannot come within the span of a human lifetime, that there should be alternatives out there, that the soul will make that journey back to God. And this is the viewpoint that is associated with Origen, who was a great thinker of the ancient world, and who was very interested in that notion that suffering had to have a purpose. It had to purify the soul. There had to be, in a sense, a positive that would come out of the suffering in the world.
But I think there's another theme that emerges here with evangelical ideas about hell, and it is in the sort of conservative or orthodox elements of Judaism or Christianity or Islam, where the belief in hell still persists. But that's the question of, should you go to hell because of your beliefs? So in a lot of the discussions about hell in evangelical sects, basically anybody who doesn't confess Christ goes to hell,
right?
Which, you know, disturbs most people in the secular world, that you'd be sent for your beliefs. But that's an old Christian belief, too, that somehow not just your actions, but also your beliefs might send you to hell.
See, but you were talking about origin. Mm-hmm. I mean, early in the early days when the early Christians were trying to sort of canonize their ideas and their beliefs and where they were going to go with all of this, I mean, Origen presented this idea that of universal salvation, that hell didn't need to be for eternity. It didn't need to be so hot. Right, and it could be a place where people could work out their problems and then come back to the, as Kevin put it, the community of saints. But that idea was rejected. Mm-hmm. He was excommunicated. Mm-hmm. He was excommunicated after he was dead.
Yes, right.
I love it.
So what does that say? I mean, yes. So that didn't stick. I mean, Christians, at least early Christians, liked the idea of there mm-hmm. being some place that was really fiery.
Right. And, you know, but it doesn't happen immediately. I mean, the point is that Origen was condemned after his death, and actually significantly after his death. Mm. He's condemned at a point, you know, historically when the movement has gone much more sort of in the direction of a punitive, eternal, you know, fire and brimstone kind of hell idea.
But that comes later, huh?
But it comes late. But that comes later. I mean, you know, Origen's views would not have struck the Christian of that time as anything unusual. And that's really important for us to remember, is that, you know, when we sort of think about a Christian hell in this sort of traditional fashion, we're actually thinking of a hell that comes out very largely out of the description of Augustine, you know, Augustine of Hippo, who really sort of sets the theological thread for the Middle Ages and beyond.
And it sticks for centuries.
And it sticks for centuries, although, you know, interestingly, and this is what we found in our collection, again and again, there are attempts to assault this sort of very punitive, very negative, dark view of hell. You know, Origen comes across as a much more positive view. And you know, I think in many respects, Origen's views are quite in tune with more modern ideas about
Christians are coming back to them.
Christians are coming back to them, and you know, Origen, you know, himself, even just as a figure, is being given greater respect in the modern world than he was given in the medieval world.
And from my perspective, what this indicates is the sort of swing of the pendulum, which for me reflects this psychological tension that I mentioned before. That we both want to punish people who are really bad, but we also want to have mercy and compassion for most people. And so if you look at the history of Christianity, I think there is a sort of swinging back and forth in subtle and broad ways between those poles of Origen and Augustine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also just that, you know, sin and infractions and the like, you know, are sometimes best handled by education. You know, it's a good message for the modern era.
That's Isabel Morera, professor of history at the University of Utah, and Margaret Toscano also with us, an associate professor of classics and comparative literature here at the U. Together, they are editors of the book Hell and Its Afterlife. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about hell as an idea and as a place. And we have with us the scholars Isabel Morera and Margaret Toscano, both from the University of Utah. They're co-editors of a book called Hell and Its Afterlife. Here's an email, I guess, from Stephen, who writes, "I'm a huge believer in creating one's own reality. Repeatedly in my life, I've been able to conjure both heaven and hell. So yes, I believe in hell. However, I'm also smart enough to find my way out." Here's something from David, who writes from West Jordan. He writes, "How about hell as a place where God and Jesus are not? Not necessarily a bad place, but knowing that you're not in a place where they are, obviously put there by actions done in life that prevents us living among them." Now, Margaret Toscano, that sounds like a very Mormon concept of hell, does it not? This idea, and talk a little bit about Mormon concepts of hell. Mormons do believe in a particular kind of hell, but it's for very few sorts of people. Generally, the idea is David's expressing, and I'm not assuming that he's Mormon, but this sounds a bit Mormon, does it not? The idea that hell is not, you know, a bird picking at your gallbladder for eternity. It's
separation from God.
Separation, right.
And
right,
also
right.
from those you love, perhaps. So I think Mormonism is very interesting historically in how it is positioned and how it positions hell, because coming out of an American tradition from the 19th century, it very much partakes of a movement toward a more universalism. So really, you could say that Mormon theology is very soft on hell, that yes, they have this idea of there's the sons of perdition, but very few go there, and you don't even know what happens to them. There is an indication in Mormon scriptures that there may be a place of punishment for those who are really bad after they die, but eventually everyone other than the sons of perdition are going to be saved in some kind of a kingdom of glory, which Joseph Smith described as much better than where we live now. So if you're in the telestial kingdom or the terrestrial kingdom, the terrestrial, you may be separated from God and people you love who were better than you are, but you're not going to have eternal torment. It's going to be a pretty good place. I mean, maybe
it's not eternal torment, it's eternal regret.
Well, maybe for some, but maybe for others not. I mean, maybe you'd rather be down somewhere with Socrates drinking wine and talking philosophy, right?
Right.
So, but I think it's interesting that for a lot of Mormons, or at least I sense this when I talk to them, the idea of being separated from your family even more than from God is for them the place of torment. And that says a lot about LDS culture.
Let's see. Randall writes this. The Catholic theologian and philosopher Gabriel Marcel wrote, "Only the irrevocable is serious." And Randall writes, there's an interesting tension there. If there is eternity, only the permanent would be serious. There's deep psychological usefulness to the idea of eternal punishment. What do you think?
Well, the idea, again, of eternal versus maybe change, and this is a big theological and also philosophical debate, you know, if we go back to Mormon theology, is there progression? Is there movement in the next life? Is stasis the thing? Is stasis good or boring? Or is, you know, change good or boring? I mean, these are huge questions, which, again, I think are very important for both theologians and philosophers.
Was there a hell in the Old Testament?
Not the way that we think of hell, not as sort of as a moral hell. You know, to sort of come back to this issue, though, of change and regret, I think that's so interesting because, you know, one of the consequences of descriptions of hell that are eternal as they're sort of they're described in the Christian tradition is that souls in hell can have no regret, at least in the sort of the earliest ideas about hell, because that did suggest movement. That did suggest that repentance, could occur. But if you're going to have a final, eternal hell, then you really have to put people in there who have no regret, who have no ability to be sorry for what they have done. And, you know, the earliest texts really try to handle that notion. And so, you know, we have descriptions of hell where the vision of Paul, where Paul goes down into hell and the people in hell are complaining about the fact that they've been left there and they are very unhappy and they're asking for mercy. But it's really clear that they're just complaining, that, you know, they're not truly turning. They're not truly remorseful. They're not truly turning. And so, again, you know, hell is a serious business. I mean, hell is a sort of when it becomes thought of as a place of permanence, you have to be very careful about who you're putting down there.
On the other hand, I think that Dante and the Inferno presents characters that seem to regret, whether or not it's sincere or not, I suppose, is a matter of interpretation.
Right.
But I think if we go back to the psychological hell, regret can be part of the psychological hell.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to make a comment about the Bible. I think it's important to note that there's not one idea of hell either in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, or in the New Testament, the Christian Bible. That in both of those documents, which were produced over a lot of years with different authors, at least scholars believe that, right?
Mm-hmm.
that you have various views. So in the Old Testament, once you get to Daniel and Ezekiel, some of the later books, mm-hmm. a notion of hell and fire and brimstone does begin to emerge. And often those in hell in those visions and those prophetic visions are those who have persecuted the Jews or the people of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so, again, hell is always in process, that whether you're talking about the Bible or any other context, views change about hell. And that's certainly true in the Bible. You find various beliefs about hell within that book.
And sort of mostly those sort of those views are in the apocalyptic text that sort of were sort of chronologically sort of later in the Bible.
Like Revelation.
The book of Revelation or the book of Ezekiel and Daniel. They are later books. And also the term apocalyptic is very important here because it goes back to images of Rwanda or the Holocaust, where out of a context of persecution and extreme suffering, you start getting discussions about mm-hmm. hell.
So hell, in some way, came here first, and we then gave it some cosmological story.
I agree. If you look at that apocalyptic context, mm-hmm. I think that's true.
I wanted to ask you, Jesus Christ, does he say anything about hell in the Bible? Do we know what Jesus says?
He's quoted.
He's quoted.
So in Matthew 25, I had it here somewhere, but I don't know if I want to bother to find it. There's a statement that's attributed to Jesus that talks about, "Depart from me and go to the fires of hell." But if you look at the overview of the New Testament in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you have ideas of hell and suffering. If you go to the Gospel of John or Paul, there is more of a tendency toward believing in a universal salvation.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, it's Jesus's parable about the rich man and Lazarus, which of course is the great story about, the existence of hell as this sort of great chasm that divides the righteous from the unrighteous.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. But I think it's important that in that vision, the sin mm-hmm. of the rich man mm-hmm. is that he ignores the poor. Mm-hmm. And so that's fascinating to me, that what Jesus seems to be condemning there is this social inequity.
Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, that makes it entirely relevant to the modern age.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. You say that we already talked about the fact that we hear more and more religions rejecting a literal idea of a hell, but that it's popping up more and more in popular culture. So it gets us to, we have about a minute and a half left or so. It seems like you don't think hell is going away anytime soon. It's something that's useful whether we believe in it literally or not. We're going to stay with the ideas of hell?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, I think that it's just simply so useful and so universal a language to talk about hell, as Margaret mentioned earlier. I don't see it going away. I think that, people are always going to be looking for justice. And, hell seems to encapsulate that idea for people, today, just as it did in the past.
Well, and unless we can get rid of cruelty and violence and suffering, I think we're going to always have hell, too, because it is a language. This is the hell is a series of metaphors and statements that help us explore that. So I don't think we're going to get rid of it. And from my perspective, one of the fascinating things is it's almost as though as soon as you get rid of it in religion, it pops up in popular culture. Mm-hmm. That it's like we think we're rid of it and then we're not. We see it in this other context. Mm-hmm.
We didn't have time, Margaret Toscano, to talk about this compelling chapter of yours called Love is Hell. There's a whole show there. We'll maybe do it around Valentine's Day.
Oh, I would love that. The Cupid and Psyche Myth.
Margaret Toscano, an associate professor of classics and comparative literature at the University of Utah, thank you very much for being with us. And Isabel Morera, professor of history at the university, together editors of the book Hell and Its Afterlife. Professor Morera, thank you very much to you as well.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.